Welcome back to the Medieval Irish History Podcast. We are discussing a fairly huge topic today, which is something that kind of underpins a lot of the discussions we've been having, but it is essentially early Irish law. It's often known to a lot of Irish people as Brehon law. I would say this term kind of isn't really very appropriate for use until the later Middle Ages, but maybe our guest will have something to say about that. In the later Middle Ages, it was used kind of in opposition to English law or common law after that was introduced. And I think the term Brehon came from the early Irish word for a judge, and judges definitely had a high status in medieval Ireland. And this legal system was in force from maybe at least the 7th century, when we have some of the earliest surviving texts, until the 17th century. And our guest today is Professor Robin Chapman Stacey of the University of Washington, so all the way over in the west coast of the US. Welcome, Professor Stacey. It's early there in the morning for you, I think.
Thank you, but I've got my tea.
Yeah,
in hand,
excellent.
So that's good.
And Professor Stacey is a historian who has mainly specialised on the laws of early medieval Ireland and Wales. One particular thing, she has a lot of works you can check out, but there's a brilliant YouTube video online of the public lecture, Robin, you gave at the School of Celtic Studies of the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, their statutory public lecture a number of years ago. But also, you have really notable books, including The Road to Judgment from Custom Court in Medieval Ireland and Wales, and your book on dark speech. So, as I said, thank you and welcome. Can you just kind of, as with a lot of my guests, can you give us a kind of a general introduction or overview? What are we talking about when I say early Irish law?
Right. Well, actually, Niamh, I was thinking this morning about how much and how much the answer to that question has changed in many ways since I first entered the field in basically the Pleistocene era. I mean, the body of text hasn't changed. So what we're talking about there is a remarkable, truly remarkable, within the European context, body of legal tracts, and that is the form it largely takes in Ireland, dating to the high point is sort of 650 to 750, I think. There are some, a few later texts, and then there's an extensive tradition of glossing and commentary that actually goes well into the late Middle Ages. But the main body of early Irish law are these tracts. And I mean, I cannot tell you how amazing they are within the European context. So these laws are being written largely at the same time that other early medieval kingdoms are writing their laws as well. And some of your, if some of your listeners are into early medieval law, they will know about Anglo-Saxon law or Frankish law or Visigothic law. Many of these kingdoms produced law codes, as we usually refer to them, when we're talking about the Germanic laws, in roughly the same period, and then, you know, in later centuries. There are some real differences between the Irish and the Germanic language codes. For one thing, the Germanic codes are often associated with kings, though not inevitably, and not actually necessarily in the earliest manifestation. The Irish codes are more descriptive. The other the Irish tracts are more descriptive. The Germanic ones are more prescriptive, I guess you'd call it. But what really matters is this huge body of legal material covering an enormous range of subjects. Some of them, you know, really serious. Some of them really small, like how do you keep bees and what do you do with cats and things? And then some of them really huge, like status and clientship and relations between people. But that's roughly what we're talking about, this huge body of textual material. And the most important thing about it is that so much of it in Ireland is in the vernacular.
Yeah.
A lot of it's in Latin, but a lot of it is in the vernacular.
Yeah, and that's massive. And that's, I suppose, your particular specialty. Is it the vernacular? So the vernacular is kind of like the non-Latin language in kind of each jurisdiction. So in the case of Ireland, it was Old Irish or then Middle Irish. In Wales, it was Old Welsh. It would have been Old English and Anglo-Saxon England. I don't know if we can say Anglo-Saxon England anymore, actually. We were talking a few weeks ago with Elva Johnston, about all of these. We have to change so much of our, nomenclature and everything and how we describe things because traditional ways have been so limiting, you know. But anyway, in different jurisdictions, but Latin. So you had Latin and the vernacular, in most law codes. And I think what you've shown so well throughout your career is the uniqueness of how rich the vernacular, so not the Latin law texts necessarily, but more so specializing in the Irish ones. And the Welsh, of course, but we won't get into the Welsh.
Those are the ones that have interested me most. But of course, there's huge amounts of work to be done in both traditions, not least in trying to understand more closely the relationships between those traditions, the Latin and vernaculars.
And this is one of the best things why I love in particular studying Ireland is because we have so many texts in both languages. You're able to compare and contrast sometimes in some cases. So, for example, my own work previously, and not so much anymore, is on the cult of relics. And it's just so interesting to see how particular relics were described in some texts, sometimes when we knew exactly what was being referred to, when you could see what word was used in Irish and what word was used in Latin, it just gave you so much more of an understanding of the actual object or how it was used or what significance it had. And that's something that you just don't get to the same extent in other places, in Europe, that you have so much of the, of so many Irish texts as well as Latin texts.
Exactly. I mean, when you look at some of the early medieval laws that are being written at the same time or roughly the same time as the Irish texts, one of the things that's really interesting is that the sources make it clear that there is something of a legal vernacular that lie behind these Latin texts. And, there's a whole series of very famous Frankish glosses, the Malberg glosses, and just sort of small bits of words inserted here and there to let you see something of that vocabulary. But it's nowhere close to what we have from Ireland, where you get these really, they're not only complete sentences, they're looking at things, they're examining practices, they're demonstrating them through changes in types of language. I mean, one of the things that's so interesting is, and we know this just from our own lives, right, that we speak different in different ways in the same language in different contexts. And, I might use formal language that has a totally different kind of set of implications than if I use slang.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the things that the Irish texts, I think, allow us to do is to look at how those different types of languages actually structure relationships and structure people's relationships with one another. I think that's pretty amazing. And and the early English codes, and I absolutely take the point about Anglo-Saxon, the early English codes, you can do some of that, but they're very different in their style and their way of writing, in the fact that most they're attached to kings, they're prescriptive. You get a lot less, it's harder.
Okay.
It's a lot harder.
Okay,
and there's not nearly as much.
Okay, great. And let's maybe, hopefully we'll have time. We're always so tight on time. But hopefully we might have time to maybe delve into that a little bit more detail later on. And as well, if we did have time, is compare the Irish laws with the Welsh ones as well. That'd be great every time. But anyway, so tell me what kind of legal system do these texts tell us about? What kind of legal system did we have in Ireland? Are we, am I correct in saying that the system was based kind of on compensation more so than the state dominated system we kind of have in place in a lot of jurisdictions today?
Absolutely. And that's one of the difficulties that modern people have approaching early medieval laws, because we're dealing with a very different type of society. We think of law as something issued by the state, enforced by the state. these are not that type of society. This is a sort of society that is often referred to, or at least used to be referred to, as stateless. It's not really stateless, but what it means is that law is not something that everybody has to obey in the same ways at the same time, and it's not something enforced by a state. It's a system of customs and ways of ordering relationships, some of which may involve a king, a state, or a judge acting in concert with a king, or a judge acting together with parties in dispute. You know, there's a wide variety of things. There's a fluidity to it that doesn't exist in the modern day. The society that we see in the Irish laws is very hierarchical.
Yeah.
Very much attuned to status distinctions. Mm-hmm. It's rural. It's small, community focused. It's, you know, it's a very different type of society. Law is going to, if you and I are in dispute and I'm refusing to give back the cow I stole from you, you know, chances are that the way you're going to get it back is through either through bringing shame on me or distraining against me, coming, you know, to my place and performing a series of kind of public rituals, letting everybody know why you're about to do what you're going to do. And then you snag my cow or you snag pigs or something like that to make it clear that there's something that needs to be done here. It's a very different type of law. One of the biggest differences, I think, for your listeners would be this issue of hierarchy.
Yeah.
This is not a society in which equality is a value. It's the opposite. You know, the inequality is kind of a moral value. It's, and you know, it's taken for granted that people who are higher in status should have more privileges, more leeway, more prerogatives. Yeah. You know, that's something really different than it would be for us. And I think it speaks to the big gulf between our society and theirs.
Yeah, and it's such a restrictive society that's shown in the law text, isn't it? That social mobility was difficult.
Yes, very much so. And I mean, you think about the society portrayed in the laws, and it's really very local in most cases. And, you know, the presumption behind it is essentially that many of these people are never going to leave, you know, this small area in which they grew up or function. Now, you know, there would be exceptions to that, craftspeople, obviously persons of political power looking to extend their power, etc. But this is a small community, and any of your listeners who've ever grown up or spent time in a small town will know how these things function. And a lot of how communities function when they're functioning well has nothing to do with the enforcement of law. It has to do with things like gossip and talking about people and, you know, who is avoided or ostracized and who is not.
That's such a good point, because
that's
sorry to cut across you, but that's such a good point, because we have in so many ways, such an individualistic society now.
Yeah.
And that it may be even, it's not the hierarchy that's most alien to us, it's that element where you're actually legally tied to many other people.
That's right. I think it's a really essential point. And honestly, you know, you mentioned earlier about differences and similarities between Germanic and Irish law. I mean, I think one of them is right there, that the Irish laws over and over and over and over again emphasize all the time the ways in which individuals are tied to one another. Yeah. And that they do that by focusing on particular types of relationship, marriage, for one, clientship, how does agriculture get done, lordship, hostage ship. I mean, there's a whole commercial relations. There's a whole variety of those. And they're really concerned to show all of those persons in those relationships. And that's true for the people higher up on the scale, too.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's important. Part of what makes them important are all the people that surround them and all the people to whom they're linked.
Yeah, I love kind of the way kings are described in some of the law texts, you know, like that, you know, they can't be involved in manual labor or that kind of thing, or they can't go out without an entourage of a certain size. You know, like you can't be a baller unless you have, you know, a certain amount of people at your beck and call, unless during harvesting, you know, season. Or
absolutely. I don't know. Did you ever see, there's a book on Inishmurry, the monastic island.
Yeah.
Of
oh, Tomás O'Carrigan's one, is it?
It could be. It's sitting on my shelf somewhere, but I'd never find it in time. Anyway, I mention it because it has a picture with a caption, "The Last King of Inishmurry." Now, kingship was not, as far as we know, native to Inishmurry. There's a whole thing in the book about how they decide one night after, I think a ship runs aground with lots of barrels of whiskey, and so much drink is taken, and they decide in the ensuing party, we really need a king, blah, blah, blah. So they appoint a king. But the point is that that kingship title, right, it keeps going on till the island itself is evacuated. But what's great is this king is sitting right next to this other guy who lives on Inishmurry. And that you can't tell the difference between them. I mean, the last king of Inishmurry, I actually often show this picture to my classes and I say, okay, which one is the king and which one and why? And of course, you know, they make guesses and some are right and some are wrong. But the point is you can't tell. And the reason you can't tell is because in a society, a small community like that, where there's not vast disparities in wealth, then it's the performative things, you know, the small objects you might have, or the entourage, as you mentioned, or, you know, the language in which you're addressed or whatever. That's what makes you stand out as king.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to look like some other
Yeah, I love it. But yeah, so we have like this, as you said, so it's a hierarchical, very highly stratified society where you have kings all the way down to slaves. And everything in between. And the laws think that this is a great thing. You know, that this is the proper way in which you should run a society.
That's right.
Yeah. And where do women fit into that scheme?
Well, women, I mean, one of the interesting things to me, and I'm sure you've run into this, there's a sort of widespread popular impression that early Celtic society and early Irish society were sort of a period of equality and a great time for women.
Yeah.
And I've got to say that nothing in the laws really supports that.
Yeah.
In fact, quite the opposite. When you're talking about that early Irish society actually quantifies honor, women's honor price is half that of the corresponding male. It's clear that in certain circumstances, women's contractual authority might be limited. The tracts kind of disagree in how they put this. Some say, you know, women can never engage in contractual stuff. Most of them acknowledge a kind of situational restrictions, but it's clear that those restrictions are there. Yes, women could inherit land, but you know, if they're, we were mentioning this before we went started recording. If women want to give a pledge to someone to guarantee that they'll do something, you know, they have real restrictions on what they can give as a pledge. They can't give the ordinary good stuff from the household. They give things like a needle, an embroidery needle, or, you know, a work bag or something like that. Things that are very marked in terms of gender, very performative in terms of gender, and that form a huge contrast with what the guy could give,
yeah,
you know, which is the sort of mainstream stuff.
So then within this system, this might be an unfair question, but it's kind of something that sometimes comes up in some of my lectures. What is more important? I feel bad asking you this. In this situation then, kind of like gender or as we understand it, or as, you know, kind of it's understood in the law as, you know, like women make babies kind of thing, or they grow babies. Gender or status? Is that a main question?
That's a great question. This is going to sound like a weasel answer, but it is my actual answer. One of the things about early medieval social relationships that are or are not governed by law, or are governed by law and by other things, is fluidity.
Okay.
And status, high status, is always going to matter.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. And there's no question, I think, but that a woman of great status might well be able to do a lot more and be perceived as being worth more by her contemporaries than a lower status guy.
Yeah.
But that's not the same thing as saying that they operate in the same spheres. I don't think I think fluidity is the only way to think about this. If you pose the question, status versus gender, to me, I then want to know the situation. I want to know the individuals, who their relationships are, with whom. You could have a kind of medium status woman who had a very powerful male protector.
Yeah.
That, you know, and the laws don't, make room for that sort of complication.
Okay.
It's one of the frustrations, the challenges, I suppose, of working with legal texts, that they invent these categories. And then, of course, as you know, anytime we have personal relationships, things escape from those categories. So that would be my answer. I'd need to know which woman, which status, which, you know, I was about to say which gender, which which isn't quite what I mean.
Yeah,
but,
no.
But it is, actually. Yeah. There's a, you'll be aware of this. Yeah. There's a wonderful article written by a long time ago by a woman named Carol Clover on talking about the single sex theory of gender in the early Middle Ages, that what mattered was less your physical gender. You know, were you biologically male or biologically female, than how you acted, you know, and that a weeny kind of guy could be regarded as effeminate and kind of and placed on the effeminate, the female point of the scale in terms of what he could do. I mean, there's all sorts of questions about where that applies and how you use it and all of that sort of stuff. But that's what I mean about, you got to know the characters. Yeah. You got to know the principles.
You have given me a very good answer to an unfair question. So thank you for that. That there was a little lesson from the professor emeritus that there is no simple answer to these, you know, big binary questions.
On the other hand, that doesn't make the questions any less important.
No, well,
that's an important question.
Yeah,
I ask it of students all the time.
So you hinted earlier that there, you know, the Irish law, the text covers so many different topics, you know, from vast things like rank and status to things that are, more specialized. So can you kind of give us a bit of a flavor on kind of other things, other topics that are covered by the law?
Well, sure. Let's see. And first of all, let me just talk about how many of these things there are. I think Liam's survey has like 54.
Liam Bannach, I'll say.
But one of them is a compilation that itself almost has 50. 50 tracks. Now, not all of those are extant. Some we just know from titles or from, you know, brief excerpts or whatever. But that's an amazing number of tracks. In terms of subjects, they cover all sorts of stuff. Status, to me, is one of the most interesting and one of the most important. Clientship, which is the ways that lords and clients relate to one another. It's also implicated in how agriculture gets done. There's a big tract on the law of neighborhood. But what that means are sort of like, how do small farmers live together? What are the problems that they have? And you can think, you can see about this, you know, if you've got an animal and it goes charging over and it wrecks somebody else's pigsty or something like that, you've got to have a way to deal with that. Or bees, there's an entire tract on beekeeping, for heaven's sake. And it actually has one of my favorite things. What happens if you are an innocent passing and you're stung by someone else's bee? Well, I mean, you're owed compensation for your injury, right? And but the deal is, and I think the compensation is something like you get a meal made with honey or something from the beekeeper, unless you killed the bee. Because if you killed the bee, then, you know, justice has already been done. The bee had the death
All
penalty.
square. So that scene is
Poor
resolved.
bee, there you are. You don't get your meal of honey.
You mentioned compensation, and we kind of were talking about the kind of system of compensation a little bit earlier, and in relation to status and everything, that a crime, was it better then to commit, so if it's hierarchical and each person, your worth, you have a defined worth, each individual. So is it better then to commit a crime against someone who's lower down society? Like, if I want to steal something or commit a violent crime, I should pick someone who's not of high status because there'll be a higher compensation to be paid?
I love the idea of prospective burglars sitting around going, okay, so who would be best for me to kind of rip off here? I mean, you've got to wonder whether people really low down the status ladder of the sort who might not count very much, frankly, for law, how much they would have that you would want to steal. But again, and you know, I'm sorry to sound like a broken record, but what happens if that person lower down the social ladder happens to have a really powerful patron? Because if that person is attached in any way to a powerful lord, then you've not only infringed on the property and honor, if that lower status person has honor to themselves, not only on theirs, but on the honor of the higher status protector. So, I mean, yes, it would be less costly in theory to, you know, go beat up the guy beneath you. And you know, chances are maybe that people would be less likely to care. But again, these legal situations are very fluid, and it's not as easy. The law makes categories because it has to have categories as a way of talking about things. But you know from your own life that categories only go so far, right? And that most of us don't fit entirely into one category. And that's true for them too. In general, yeah, lower status people, not going to be cared about as much, et cetera. But, you know, whether your hypothetical burglar would be better off making that sort of, well, I think I'll go down the road and get Fred, because nobody cares about
Nobody
Fred.
cares.
Okay.
Rob's like, why are you even thinking that way? Like, what are the limitations to what these texts can tell us? You know, like, how useful, as a historian, how can we make use, as historians, how do we make use of these legal sources?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. And frankly, it's one on which I think a lot of work is and has been done. When people first started studying early medieval law, and here I'm thinking continental law, Rex Schule, 19th century, I mean, they took it for as literal, and they took everything as objectively stated. I understand that. And that idea about law has carried into modern historiography. Of course it would. You know what, how do we think about law? We without thinking, we impart to ancient sources the associations we ourselves have with sources. And if we know something is law, then we're inclined to regard it as objective. And you know, for centuries, decades, whatever, that's been the way that people write about law. I would also say that in a certain sense, it has to be, because these are societies for which we have very little information otherwise. So, you know, the laws which purport to describe what society is like they're our primary source of information for what is early Ireland like, what is early Francia like, you know, that sort of thing. So we've got to use them in some ways. But you don't have to get very far into law, and this has been a huge question in early medieval legal studies, to notice that there are problems with that, with taking it literally. There are some things that just seem ridiculous. There are some things that just seem that are clearly archaic or outmoded. There are other things that just contradict one another. Yeah. You know, the minute you say, well, I'm going to just take these as literal, you're in trouble. And, you know, scholars now are very attuned to things like strategies of representation and the ways in which language can shape our thinking about things. And when you apply that kind of reading to a body of literature like law, things become very difficult. One of the great early medieval historians, Chris Wickham, has made it clear that he has basically no time for early medieval laws. Depressing to read is what he says. And, you know, they're not exactly scintillating.
Yeah, but he's
going to
say that about modern law texts as well.
Well, of course. I mean, yeah, if you sat down to have a good time with a modern law text, you'd
pass it into a coma. You know, early, you know, legal texts and everything's like, yeah, they're boring. They're boring now. They're always boring. It's the law. Like, it's, but actually the Irish ones are fascinating. Like, they're the exception.
Actually, I think they're all fascinating, okay. Honestly. But I think you need to read them in a different way.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you're reading them for, you know, okay, what happened if someone's cow gets stolen?
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's a legal question. It's important. I'm in no way decrying that. But I think there are lots of ways to read these early medieval legal texts. I think the Irish are better in terms of reading these because they're more narrative and because they're in the vernacular, so you can actually see the language.
Yeah.
But I think if you read them more like social theorizing, which is what I believe they were, honestly, as much as anything else.
By that, do you mean
even read them as literature?
Yeah.
They read very differently.
Do you, by social theorizing, do you mean that the people who are writing these texts were working out how society should function? Or
I think they are.
Yeah.
I think they are. And I think in Ireland, now this, you know, this may be a special case, and here we get into what you can see in Irish law and what's much more difficult to see in early medieval Germanic law. But I think in Irish law, you can actually see them trying to work out one of the great problems of the age. You know, you've got a pagan society, Christianity comes in, it's got its own personnel and its own series of laws. Whatever is in place before Christianity comes in seems to have its own personnel and at least ways of, I don't know if I should say laws, but ways of ordering relationships among people. These two meet and mingle. How does that happen? Well, this is amazing because this is, I mean, frankly, it happened all over Western Europe, but it's only in places like Ireland and to some degree also in early English literature where we can see them working that out. How do they do that? And in Ireland, we know that the laws are one of the vehicles through which they are working out this new Christian society. What does it look like? And that's what I mean by social theorizing. Yeah. Now, in early England, it's more difficult, and in Francia also, because of the association with kings, etc. But there too, you know, even through the Latin, you can see it. There's a man named Karl Ubel, who's a wonderful historian at Cologne, who's written what is in essence a biography of Lex Salica, of the Salic law. And he goes through all the different versions of it. And they each have a different message.
Yeah, okay.
They each have a different theme. They each put things differently, even within the context of the same, you know, punitive laws.
Yeah.
I think that's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I
that
think
is
that's really,
really
cool. Amazing. And I think it's a way that of reading law that really opens it up and gets us past the sort of, well, were they actually enforced? Which is an important question, but frankly, one we're only going to be able to answer a little bit.
Yeah, and even enforcement is a constant. I mean, that's the same today. That's a whole, it's a separate question, isn't it? You know, you know, like, I know jaywalking, for example, again, in the States, you know, is a law. I think someone can correct me. I think it might be a law that's could be in place in Ireland as well, that nobody respects because it's not
nobody
enforced.
Does it. Yeah.
But you know you shouldn't just cross the road wherever because it's dangerous. You know, as in, like, we understand that it's there for a reason, to protect people from getting hit by cars. Like you referred to the sheer vastness of early Irish law, both in the amount of texts that survive, and also the topics that are covered. So does that in itself tell us that this legal system was really important, and that tells us a lot about medieval Ireland? Or does it just tell us a lot about the lawyers and the legal class and the legal practitioners who
us about both.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the really interesting things that's come out in the past some years through Liam Bronach's work is there's a big legal compilation called the Seanchus Mar, the Great Tradition. And as I said, it contained, as far as we can tell, almost 50 tracts in itself, although many are not extant now, but we have titles for them. And what he's argued is that this was all put together in one place at the Monastery of Armagh as a deliberate thing. Well, that's amazing. Mm. That is astonishing, to think of somebody undertaking that, of, you know, either bringing in tracks from wherever they're coming in from. And, you know, there are a lot of questions still to be asked about that, about editing them, about putting them together. One of the things that holds them together is the story of how St. Patrick, you know, comes and he listens to what native pagan legal tradition was, and then he gets rid of things that don't go along with Christianity and then reissues it basically under his authority. And that's what we now have. I mean, that's social theorizing right there. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, you know, when you then go to these individual tracts and you read about specific laws, like what happens if my dog poops on your land, what, you know, those specific laws, that then becomes the question, right, of how do you read those and how do we understand those? And but that's amazing. That's amazing to have. What we don't have from Ireland, and this is regrettable, are charters and judicial records that show how or if these things might have been applied. And presumably that's in part because justice was usually oral.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go. I mean, the annals give us little kind of hints and insights into referencing, but the annals are such, so the annals are kind of, roughly speaking, kind of yearly records of the big headline news, according to the people who were writing down the headlines. But yeah, let's talk a little bit then about law's performance, if you're saying, you know, that it's kind of a bit more of an oral act.
Yes, I and here we do come up against the question you raised earlier about who these judges are and who these lawyers are. And and my ruminations of earlier this morning about when I first went into this field, the main reason people were interested in early Irish law is because there was so much poetry in it and so much was presumed to be pagan and archaic that it was thought that Irish law could give us insights into really ancient practices like Common Celtic and maybe even further back in Indo-European. And the presumption there was, you know, law as poetry being recited the same forever and ever and ever and ever through the ages, et cetera, and then finally is written down. That whole understanding has changed in my working lifetime. And we now understand these lawyers to be certainly to be trained in ways similar to those of clerics. I'm trying to stay away from the issue of whether they were all clerics, because that's a big controversy.
Let's just say they weren't. But, let's just say they weren't all, you know, that, because everything ends up being not black and white, you know, it's all.
Right,
it's
exactly.
All nuanced, yeah.
And but, you know, they are trained in way, many of the law tracts actually follow the language and the style of early Latin grammar tracts. So you know that the people who wrote them had that sort of training. Mm. Now, performance, there's still enough, there are very different styles of language visible in these tracts. Some of it is what you would call normal Irish, like you could actually read it if you were a normal person. And some of it is this poetic stuff that used to be thought to be archaic, that we now know isn't necessarily archaic. And we know that because of a couple of really important articles published in 1984, right in the middle, I might say, of when I was doing my dissertation. And let me tell you, that is not when you want groundbreaking work to be published right in the middle of your dissertation. And these articles showed, well, wait, these things that we thought were pagan and archaic are actually translations of ecclesiastical tracts from a later
date. It's like, insert biblical reference here, insert biblical reference
exactly.
there.
And so, yikes, you know, all of a sudden, yikes, totally different understanding. So we now know these guys are definitely Christian. Mm. If it's right to think of this big compilation being put together at Armagh, which I happen to think is right, I think that makes a lot of sense, then we have information on where people are, or at least some of the places where people might be learning to do what they're doing. The issue of performance then comes in because there's enough evidence to suggest that part of what gives legal people, judges, lawyers, their authority in legal dealings is their ability to speak in this kind of poetic, arcane mm-hmm. language. That may not be the only thing that gives them authority, but I think that's what the evidence suggests to me. And if you think about it, you're somebody out in Connaught with the Evrean or whoever, and you've got a judge who maybe was educated somewhere totally different, in the East. How do you know that they know what they're talking about? Mm-hmm. Well, I think partly language is part of the answer to that. Their ability to speak in this poetic tongue. Yeah. That may not be the only thing, but I think it's there. Much the same, estimation made of poets. How do you know if a poet is good?
Yeah.
Et cetera. That's what I think. But I think that's also an area where there's lots of work yet to be done.
Well, this is the thing. There's so much work, and there are amazing scholars who specialize in early Irish law and everything. But I suppose one of the things that you've drawn attention to is how the study of early Irish law isn't just drawn into more general discussions in what is now kind of, let's say, Western Europe, of just legal traditions across the board, that it's quite odd that, again, as with a number of other things, Ireland is seen as unique and at odds with developments. Can you tell us a little bit about how early Irish law compared with, let's say, if we just take early English law as just one example, were they similar systems, or how can we compare and contrast in a useful way?
I think that's an interesting set of questions, and I would just underscore what you said in the intro there. It is astonishing that the legal tradition that is the largest, the most substantial, and has the most vernacular of any legal tradition in early medieval Western Europe is basically unknown to historians of other early medieval traditions. In fact, there's a book written by an excellent historian on law and language in the early medieval West, and he announces right away he's not talking about Ireland. There's a whole chapter on the vernacular, but he's not talking about Ireland or Scandinavia.
Does he
Why?
Explain?
Because they're regarded as different.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of places where they're either similar or similar enough in their questions for us to be bringing Irish material in and seeing what Irish material can do with these questions that have often been identified and settled within an early Germanic corpus? And these are big questions. These are not little ones. Mm. These are things like, how do farmers farm? Gender, you know, women and yeah. gender. There's a whole brilliant article, Women and Laws in Early Medieval Europe. Ireland isn't in there.
It's
astonishing. All of these things that Ireland has to contribute. And I think that whole thing about you know, pagan, archaic, poetic, like, you know, Indo-European chanting and all of that sort of stuff. I think that is responsible for part of this assumption that it's always different and we don't have to deal with it. But that's now changed. Yeah. So we should be dealing with it. And some are, you know, I want to be fair. Alice Rio and others are dealing with it, but mostly not. Mostly not.
It is a real problem. And if we do take, let's say, one really big issue, which is that you referred to a couple of times, which is often seen as kind of like a minority thing, but the position of women, you know, occupying like roughly half of every population kind of all time. How did like the position of women in the laws compare between, let's say, Ireland, Wales and England?
I think it depends on which sources you're comparing and what you're looking at. Yeah. I think there are certain similarities across all of them. Yeah. For example, just to compare the two vernacular traditions, early England and early Ireland, a basic focus for both is the household.
Okay.
And within that, women occupy a distinctly subordinate role. There's no question. And that's true not only in the things they're described as being allowed to do. Mm-hmm. It's true in the language itself in which the household is described.
Okay.
Gender itself is an area where there's a huge amount to be gained by comparing. Early England and Francia on the one hand, with early Ireland on the other. And gender, remember, encompasses not just what women can do, but what men are thought of, what makes a man a man. We have so many TV shows now of kind of heroic Vikings and, you know, what's that Last Kingdom guy? Yeah. I've forgotten it. Destiny is all. You know, all of this sort of stuff, this kind of individualistic warrior tough guy who has the right to bear arms and but you know might restrain himself in the interests of the community. That stands in for what early medieval guys are like.
Yeah.
For everyone. Well, that's not the picture you get from early medieval Irish law at all.
No.
It's quite the opposite of what you get there. Both should be in there.
And it's
women,
funny,
I think, paradoxically, are closer. But there, too, there are some interesting distinctions. I mean, for example, women in Ireland, at least the laws say, can divorce their husbands for various things, including, you know, impotence and all of that sort of stuff. Now, we better remember that divorce is often an economic catastrophe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Women, it's not necessarily a sign of liberation.
Yeah.
But there are all sorts of things that can be compared that should be compared, because otherwise our picture of the early medieval world is completely skewed.
Yeah.
And Ireland has an enormous amount to offer in that, not least because so much of it is in the vernacular. And we can talk with Ireland and with England about words and about how words themselves create relationships and create realities.
They're so revealing. And it is, that's made me a little bit sad that, again, I feel that these boundaries have been created in a kind of modern analysis of history. You know, like dividing, keeping Ireland, you know, at odds and separate from the rest of Europe is something that has been created more recently, which wasn't the case in the period that we're talking about, you know, in early medieval Ireland, when, you know, Ireland was part of the rest of the world. And especially if we're looking at our closest neighbours in what's now Great Britain, it was all part of this, you know, one world, completely different, you know, legal systems. But they were interacting and everything. And it's sad that we have, you know, kind of like divorced them, you know, ourselves in, you know, in kind of more recent times.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we, you know, this is a period, the early medieval period is one in which texts go back and forth. Yeah. People go back and forth. We know that there are Latin texts written in Ireland that influence, have a tremendous impact on, you know, texts and thinking in Francia, for example, and obviously connections, strong connections between Britain and Ireland. I think these, you know, this kind of stereotype of Ireland as a kind of whimsical, poetic fairyland that kind of exists off, you know, to the corner, and people either do it or they don't.
Yeah.
It's just destructive for both fields. It doesn't make sense. And, you know, there are reasons for it. Irish texts are not easy. Well, they're certainly not easy to read, and they're not easy to access in libraries. It's a different type of law. The whole language issue is different, but there's a lot of places where we could be talking with one another.
And Robin, I think what you've just provided us here with today is just such a brilliant advertisement for, you know, trying, you know, for early Irish law and the study of it and understanding how it's part of just a much wider world. And I hope kind of any students out there or anyone or any scholars from other jurisdictions, especially who don't know anything about early Irish law now, are feeling a little bit more interested and motivated to kind of bring it into part of the conversation. And also perhaps, you know, message to all the kids out there, this is not sanctioned by anybody. It's only coming from Annie of Wycherley. Don't study law, study history. Study historical laws.
Well,
we need more medieval historians.
A practicing lawyer, she would probably not forgive me if I didn't mention that there is interest in practical law too. Yeah. But let us just say that
Robin, we have so many lawyers.
Myself made the choice to go into legal history and I have not regretted.
Yeah, great. We have so many and we have so few medieval historians. We're not running out of lawyers anytime soon, and we are in danger of running out of medieval historians. As Michael Potterton said in a previous episode, adopt a medievalist. Anyway, thank you so much, Professor Stacey, for you had a difficult task and you did it brilliantly well to try and cover such a ridiculously vast topic in such a short period of time. Thank you so much. And hopefully we will have you on again to just get into maybe some of the nitty gritty of some of those. You teased us with a couple of details about what does happen if your dog poops on someone else's land. We'll have to tune in again to find out.
You'll have to tune in
more.
Again. Early Irish Farming.
You're right.
Which is a great book.
I'll include
750 pages. So.
Yeah, I'll include references to Fergus Kelly's two kind of big books on that in the episode notes. So thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you guys. Nice to talk to you guys.
Thank you for listening. Please email medievalirishhistory@gmail.com with any questions or comments, or contact us on X at Early Irish Pod. The best way you can support us is by following the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and by rating the show. 5 stars is always appreciated. Thanks.